Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Hi, and welcome to the first episode of Season 2 for the Center of Everywhere. After taking a break over the summer, we're happy to be back and discuss some of the future research we have coming out this fall. On this episode, we discuss why our upcoming research will be focused around a general topic, taxes. What we thought at first was just coincidence that our topics happened to be about a specific tax policy, as we dug deeper, we realized that our research was connected by a common theme, old tax policy being implemented on a quickly shifting economic environment. Julie Tesh, our CEO and president for the Center for Rural Policy and Development, discusses this connection with the center's researchers to learn more.
Hello, and welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. My name is Julie Tesh, President and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We're happy to be back with you doing our podcast series, and we're going to jump right in talking about some big topics dealing with taxes. I know that you might groan listening to that of like, oh my goodness, but I can promise you we have some very interesting discussion. But before we get to that, we're recording this now at the end of September, and it is still summer out. And I just want to check in with my staff and if you want to tell your listeners how your summer went and if you did anything fun and exciting. So Marnie, I'll start with you.
Oh, my summer was hot and dry, but I did manage to get away for a weekend in Winona, which was really nice. Had a nice little 4-day weekend, saw a little Shakespeare theater at their Great River Shakespeare Festival, had some excellent donuts at the bakery there, and it was a very nice time, just kind of staying in state.
That's awesome. Winona is a beautiful place. Whitney, how about you? How was your summer?
Well, my summer wasn't quite as cultured as Marnie's Shakespeare, but I got out and about in Wisconsin and Minnesota quite a bit, hiking a lot, especially at Interstate Park in Taylor's Falls, my favorite place on earth. So I was happy to get up there a few times.
Awesome. Kelly, I know you had a fun summer.
Yeah, I did. I always have fun summers, bicycling around, hanging out, grilling, bonfires, all sorts of stuff. But probably the highlight of my summer was my wife and I took a road trip down to South Carolina. And it's always interesting. We always try and stay or find the kind of rural areas to stay at and explore. And that's what we did. And I don't know, it always makes me think about how different each rural area is. It always continues to baffle me that we continue to call rural America as if it means something, because it means nothing. There's just too different and too vast, and to put us, lump us all into one thing just seems, wrong.
Awesome. And myself, for the summer, you know, a second COVID summer, but I was able to get out and about, but I hit my garden really hard, my vegetable garden. And I'm like Marnie said, it was dry and hot, but a little bit of irrigation helps here and there. But then I did the quintessential rural America thing and went to a lot of county fairs and judged 4-H at several county fairs, and then worked at the Minnesota State Fair for Minnesota 4-H. So that's deep in my background, and I always enjoy going and working with the students. So summer was really good, and I'm glad that we all had a great time. And now it's back to get cranking and get rolling. So Kelly, let's talk about Amazon effect. What are you finding out?
Well, yeah. I mean, the topic really stems from, I think, during the pandemic, county commissioners and local municipal governments and policymakers in general seeing, obviously, everybody starting to shop online. You had a lot of their retail businesses shut down due to mandates. And it just kind of brought all these questions of, like, it put it front and center. How is the rise of online sales impacting our revenue sources? And for a lot of local governments, it impacts them in two different ways, right? So the first way is, and if people are unfamiliar, in Minnesota, a county or a local municipal government can charge a sales tax, up to 0.5% sales tax on all transactions in their community or jurisdictions, to pay either on the county side for transportation related projects, and on the municipal side, just special projects. It has to be kind of tied to a specific project that is going to get funded for it. I think in Minnesota, there's right around 50 towns, maybe a little more, that are charging a sales tax, and then maybe 50 some counties out of the 87 that are charging a sales tax for projects. And so, you know, some of the questions that the rise of online sales brings forth is all these different scenarios in which people are changing their shopping behaviors, and then how the taxes are connected to that. So let me provide an example. I'm in Candiohi County. And in Candiohi, the county charges a transportation sales tax on transactions here. But if I live in Olivia, which is in Renville County, just across the border, and I purchase something on walmart.com. So transaction happens in my home in Olivia from walmart.com, but I drive to Wilmer to pick up my products. Where does the sales tax get charged, right? These are the types of questions that a lot of county commissioners and local governments kind of have, is how is all this working? So part of the report is going to be kind of outlining a bunch of different scenarios in which online transactions are just vary across the board. We're no longer purchasing something in a store, feet on the ground in that specific location. Transactions are kind of happening all across the board. So we're going to be laying out a bunch of those and then kind of outlining like, okay, this is how the sales tax gets charged. And this is the jurisdiction that gets those tax monies. And this is how the Department of Revenue checks in on all that. And it's worth mentioning that this is a relatively new idea, or a new, I should say, process. It's before 2018, states were not allowed to collect state or local sales taxes from online transaction unless the business or firm in which the transaction is happening has a physical presence in the state. So I'll use Minnesota as an example. Amazon moved into the state, I think 2014, 2015, I can't remember which year it was. So before then, the state was not collecting sales tax for transactions that were online, particularly through Amazon. But once Amazon opened a distribution center in Minnesota, it had a physical presence in the state. It was then allowed to be able to charge a sales tax. And this was outlined by the Supreme Court. Well, come 2018, a new Supreme Court case, it was South Dakota versus Wayfair. The Supreme Court essentially reversed itself and said, states are now allowed to charge sales taxes and collect sales tax from online transactions from firms. And so that was kind of a big moment. And we'll outline in the report why this is happening and all the different ways in which thresholds have to be met in order for sales tax to be collected by the firms. But yeah, that was a big deal. And so I think both the pandemic, everybody's seeing online sales, online transactions, you know, increasing. And then the Supreme Court case just was kind of this perfect storm of all this information in which a lot of local leaders just couldn't sort through it and figure out how it was all transpiring. So that's on the sales tax side. And then the second way in which the increasing online sales, or we'll just call the Amazon effect, is impacting revenues is on the property tax side. And that kind of goes towards dark store theory. You know, we were working on these projects, not knowing they were related. But once we started having our research team meetings and started to talk about this, we're like, oh, there's just a fundamental shift happening in retail that is really, we've had old tax structures, we've had old assessment structures, all the stuff hasn't changed. But everything else, particularly around sales and how businesses try and make transactions, has changed substantially. And this is coming up to a head. And so one of the other ways in which local leaders and legislators want to know about the Amazon effect was how was it impacting essentially retail or Main Street businesses in small towns and in rural areas. And that one's a little harder to bring together. I'm a data guy, and to find those relationships can be a little bit harder. But we're digging into the data to kind of show the trends in the number of firms that retail, particularly retail, exist and what those trends have been going back to the early 2000s up to today. Are they declining faster than ever, or are they steady, or are they increasing? Does it depend on geography? All these types of things. So we're going to try and sort some of that out as well. But yeah, I think, you know, this fundamental shift is is occurring, and we just don't have a good grasp right now on how that's impacting different places and tax revenues.
Well, and speaking of the shift, you know, one question that I have is, now that the Supreme Court, right, has made this decision that you can collect sales tax from online stores, how does that work? Like, who gets the sales tax? Does it depend on like the address on the credit card that is being paid online? You know, like there are questions there too, and like how that's collected when you take away that brick and mortar aspect.
Yeah, it gets complex in a hurry. And we've had initial meetings and conversations with the Department of Revenue, who I think I've spent probably the last 5 years really honing in on a process to identify online only firms and getting them signed up into the system so that they make sure they're collecting those sales tax and that those firms are charging the correct sales tax to the customer or transaction that's occurring. And I'm still trying to get a definitive answer on how this works. If it's based on credit card billing address or shipping address, usually, like, let's go back to the walmart.com example, where if I'm in Olivia, but I pick it up in Wilmer, it's kind of meant to be that product was shipped to the Wilmer Walmart. So that's the tax that's going to be charged, is the Wilmer Candy Yohai tax, not the transaction that occurred in Olivia with walmart.com. And so it's kind of weird, but that's where.
So if I were to buy something online from my home here in Minnesota, but have it sent to my parents who live in northwestern Wisconsin, does Wisconsin get the sales tax?
Marnie, you can actually answer that one, because this is what you've been doing for your parents up in Anoka. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I don't know about state sales tax, but my experience is that where the sales tax goes is based on the zip code of where the package ends up. So like Kelly was saying, if I order something at Target and I am going to pick it up at Target, say the Target in Coon Rapids there, but I live in Blue Earth County, if I'm going to go and pick it up at the Target in Coon Rapids, it's based on that 55433 zip code and the sales tax that's charged there. Now, if I'm going to, well, and it's the same thing, if I'm ordering something from here in Mankato and having it shipped from Target to my parents in 55433. But if I order something here and I pick it up at the Target here in Mankato, or pick it up or have it shipped to my home, then I'm paying based on the zip code 56001. So it seems to be where that package is going to land physically. Yep. When it's, yep, delivered.
Yeah, and that's kind of the sense I've been getting to from the Department of Revenue, and the research I've been looking at is it's kind of based on that shipping address. But then there's all these other questions about what about online services like Spotify?
Yes.
And there's no shipping address. There's no
the growing segment of the online economy is those services.
Yep. And so some of the implications, this shift that's happening has some pretty significant implications as far as how and what we tax. And that's something we're starting to hear a lot more, not only amongst researchers, but also lobbyists and advocates. And I think even policymakers are starting to kind of think about this as, you know, our tax framework, our tax policy was really based on brick and mortar the idea of having brick and mortar stores and transactions occurring in person. You know, and then you would have like the magazine subscription sales, and that was kind of a different thing, but it was such a small segment. Now that it's becoming a significant segment. So for example, in 2015, online sales in Minnesota, for every $10 spent or by a consumer, $1 of it was online. Now, currently, out of every $6 spent, $1 of it is online, right? It's changing really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. And so this is a major shift in revenue and what's being transacted. And so we have to start kind of having that conversation about what are we taxing? how are online services taxed? Because some of them aren't taxed right now because they fall under a service. They're not retail. You know, Minnesota's, that's kind of our tax policy. So,
well, and here's a question. How come I pay sales tax on one streaming channel service, but not on another? You know,
I think there's still some, ambiguity in things. Mm-hmm. You know, in Minnesota, the threshold is if you're an online firm and you sell, you have 200 transactions in Minnesota with a Minnesota customer, or you sell over $200,000 or more in Minnesota, then you have to register as a taxpayer in Minnesota. And so it could be that those online services haven't met those thresholds yet. I'd find that hard to believe. Or there, it just could be like they're just kind of waiting for the Department of Revenue to find them.
Right. Well, that was my thought too, of like, like, oh, maybe we're just not going to register until, you know, somebody kind of kicks us in the butt a little bit.
Knock, knock.
But it just speaks to, right, the how the ways we buy, sell, and consume are changing and have been changing, but really, really rapidly. You know, like, I think maybe this is my naivety as a young person coming out, right? But it does seem like the way that we consume and get products has changed much more rapidly in the last 20 years than, you know, we've seen in previous generations.
Yeah. And we always say that things change in, you know, the economy and in real life much faster than policy. And policy is always running a little behind trying to catch up. And that's what we're seeing here is just, we're just in the midst of that shift.
You know, one argument I think someone could make is in our most rural counties, they've been dealing with this shift in retail for 70 years, right? As economic centers have risen and the conglomeration of all of the major retail sectors being in kind of these bigger cities, right? So like Douglas County, Alexandria is the economic center there. And they've been looking at this for 50, 60, 70 years of this occurring as transportation has increased. So one could probably argue that some of our most rural counties are going to be some of the least impacted by this because they've learned to tax other things, such as egg land and like, you know, trying to find the revenue streams from other places since they don't have a major commercial or retail center in their county or even in their community if it's a local municipal government. And so some of those shifts they've kind of already adjusted to, I feel like. And now it's like these economic centers are trying to figure out how do we adjust to this in a hurry. So,
oh, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, even growing up, I grew up in a very rural county, Wisconsin, and you had to drive almost an hour to get to the nearest Walmart, and it was in the other county. It wasn't in ours.
So was that a nice segue to the Agland report?
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, gosh, Kelly, that's just perfect. Yeah, that's perfect. So yeah, so let's talk about Agland and property taxes. You know, when we talked about this topic again, like a year ago, we were right at the beginning of the pandemic. And quite honestly, I don't want to speak for you guys, but I personally thought that history would repeat itself and that we would have land prices crashing down. And so when we first put this, we're thinking about this report, we're like, oh my gosh, what is this going to mean for rural counties when ag land values are going down? And obviously, if people have been paying attention to land prices, it is the exact opposite. We have land rising quickly, farmland rising quickly, depending upon the part of the state you're in. I'm here in southern Minnesota, and I know we have land going for between 10 and 11 in northern Iowa, 12. Pretty crazy. And so, it's all very interesting, and it's different than the 1980s farm crisis. It's different than the 2008 Great Recession. So let's help our listeners understand here what's going on.
Well, I can start off, Marnie. I kind of dug into the data for a little while and you can fill in. Does that sound good?
Sure. I was just going to talk about, you know, how ag land historically has just, well, agriculture in general historically is a very volatile industry, and land prices aren't as volatile as, say, commodity prices, but they do have those ups and downs. And so when it goes sky high, you naturally think, okay, when's it going to crash?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And like when we were looking at land value data, I mean, it was interesting from 2007 to 2012. You know, if you were to compare the net income of agriculture, it's kind of generally in Minnesota, it had this nice increasing slope line throughout those years, and land values just kind of like mirrored it identically. You know, the price per acre, the value per acre was rising just as much as the net income. But then after 2012, when that all kind of crashed and the farm net income went, you know, dropped and kind of has been dropping or staying static or not making profit or right around that kind of break and even point, land values, they're no longer increasing as fast as they were, but they're not decreasing with the performance of the financial situations of our farms. They're just kind of staying even or if increasing slightly yet. And Julie, you kind of mentioned that, seeing some of those prices in your area and in Northern Iowa. And so for whatever reason, even though agriculture can be kind of a volatile industry, investors and people that own property see ag as like a pretty consistent winner when it comes to long-term investments. And, you know, what this means as far as, you know, taxes, well, it's counties relying on ag land for a significant portion of their property tax revenue, thus their tax revenue overall and in general. So not only counties, but also school districts, which has been talked about at the legislature quite a bit over the past 5 years. And even some new policy was passed over a couple of years ago, trying to set some limits on how much school districts can get from property taxes from ag land. And so, yeah, when we were looking into this, looking at the reliance that these governments had on property tax revenue from farmland, we got nervous and we're like, oh boy, is that going to drop out? Is that just going to devastate our county budgets? And it would if the land values would decrease, but so far they're not. And I don't know, Marnie, you know, I know you're kind of taking phase two of this project, trying to identify why that is. Have you seen or heard anything yet?
Not anything super detailed yet, but I do have found in general that the buoyancy of land prices have to do really with the potential for that piece of land's ability to produce income. So like if you bought property in a place where, say you were buying some ag land in Carver County, where the suburbs are spreading outward, that property is going to be worth a lot. And it has potential for a huge payoff someday when the developer comes along knocking at your door and saying, hey, can I buy your acreage to put houses on it? This is what was happening, frankly, in Sherburne County in the 80s and 90s, where the land was selling so fast for suburban development that, you know, farmers could practically name their own price. But the thing with that is that it does have to do with location. And so we know that while ag land prices will be the highest, say, closer to the metro, when you get out farther into the real, quote, farming land, you know, real agricultural land out in western and southern Minnesota, that stops being the reason for the buoyancy. At that point, then it really does have to do with the production value, you know, and what it's being, what it's making in rent, basically, to farmers. Because, frankly, a lot of our farmland is not owned by the people who farm it; they pay rent on it. The farmers do, and that is income to the landowner. And so there's that calculus that goes into it to figure out what that income value is. And so it really is, what is the willingness of a potential buyer to pay? And so we need to do more analysis to figure out how that varies by location and by what the land is being used for or could be used for. And we'll figure that out. And then we'll, you know, look at how the where property tax revenue from ag land is growing the fastest, and how that compares to other sources of revenue, whether it's other property tax or intergovernmental funds and whatnot, and just see if we can find some commonalities in there, some patterns, and see if we can figure out what's going on so we don't have counties getting the rug pulled out from under them and suddenly having a crisis.
One question I have for you, Marnie, is that you sort of touched on this a little bit, but do these high land values for ag land, does that have an impact on farmers, really?
Well, that is a good question. And that's one of the things we have to look at is what's the rental price and how are the rent prices changing on farmland? Because the property owner pays the property taxes. And so if those property taxes are going up, logically, you would think, okay, they're going to have to charge higher rent then to the farmers so that they can afford to pay those property taxes. And that would be the situation for land that's being farmed by the person who owns it. You know, those property taxes are going sky high. I have to make more money to be able to cover these property taxes. So I'm suspecting that we're going to find that there's two different patterns going on here. One is for the effect that these rising prices, land prices, are having on farmers who own and farm the land, or on non-farmers who own the land and rent it out. And we may find, I suspect, that the non-farmers who live someplace else and own the land may not feel the need to raise rents as much on farmers because the landowner has other sources of income that they depend on, and this property is a sideline, you know, an extra investment. And so they may have it worked out so they can absorb the impact of those property taxes. But that's all something we have to look into yet.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuances in there. As you all know, and you're going to find out even more, talking about your question, Whitney, with ag land values, you know, the people, you know, say the Carver County people or the Scott County people who are getting their land bought by developers, you know, in tax code right now, you can take those dollars and find farmland and reinvest it. And so I know those of us, you know, in farm country, typically you're bidding against your neighbors, but more and more, you're not bidding against your neighbors. You're bidding against people moving out from the suburbs, or you're bidding against investors, things like that. So it's really complex, and we can go down that rabbit hole another day. But before we go, I do want to mention that if you are interested in receiving updates on our most recent research, you should go to our website at ruralmn.org, and you can sign up for our newsletter there. We send that out about every 4 to 6 weeks, and it gives a recap of what we've been up to and also gives you information on our most current research. And also, when we are releasing our research here in the coming year, each one will have a webinar with it. And so you're invited to attend that. And if you sign up for our newsletter, you'll be made aware of that as well. But our webinars are free, open to the public. We encourage you to participate in those. We also do record them and put them on our YouTube channel. So if you are interested in our research, you can go to our YouTube channel and look at our most recent research and what those webinars are. And I want to just mention one quick other thing, our website revamp on our search engine with our Rural Minnesota Journal. Marnie and Kelly, do you want to just touch on that briefly and how people can use that that new feature?
Well, sure. Back in 2006, we started a publication called Rural Minnesota Journal, and we released those for several years, I think up until about 2014, when we changed our format and went to all online. But we had a lot of very good articles that were in those journals, but it was a little tricky to get them on our website and get them searchable. And so, Kelly, you're up.
Yeah. So we're getting there. Actually, we can go around the circle here, but I actually passed it off to Whitney to try and figure out how to code them and categorize the each individual article within the Rural Minnesota Journal. So they are searchable now on our website. If you go under our research reports, there will be a search box. And if you put in there any sort of keyword that you are interested in, now within the kind of search results will be the Rural Minnesota Journal articles that are related to that keyword you guys put in. And Whitney, how are we doing on that project? Is it done yet?
Not quite done. I am making progress. We're recording this the week of September 28th. And so it should be done by the end of this week. So ideally, that means by the time this podcast is released, it should be all ready to go. Cool. With, you know, fingers crossed, nice. As always, right? But it's going well. And it's really interesting stuff. I mean, it's cool for me to, to read through this work that we've completed in the past and really help garner my own understanding, right, of the history of policy issues in rural Minnesota.
That's awesome. Very exciting things. And I know us wonky people are like really excited about that. And I'm sure our listeners are too, but just to be able to go back in those archives and see what the issues were like, you know, I don't even want to say back in the day, but back in the day in 2006, it seems like it was a long time ago. So I want to thank everyone for joining us today on this podcast. We're going to be releasing a couple podcasts a month again here now for the next several months. So make sure that you subscribe on whatever platform you listen to, and you can check out everything else on our website at ruralmn.org. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.